This podcast may contain disturbing content for some listeners. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
I probably asked you this before. Do you follow live trials at all?
Occasionally I do.
I've been watching one out of the Fairfax County, Virginia area, McLean. This one looks like it's going to have a lot of good media out there. So
what's the trial?
So this is the trial of Megan Hargan. Technically, she was found guilty in March on all counts, including first-degree murder, in the 2017 shooting death of her mother, who was 63-year-old Pamela Hargan, and her sister, 23-year-old Helen Hargan. So the allegations and the conviction come from the prosecutors theorizing that Megan Hargan staged the crime scene as a murder-suicide to make it look like it had been committed by her sister, Helen. There's like all this interesting audio coming out, but at the time that it happened, police put it out there as a murder-suicide, but detectives had already figured out that it wasn't a murder-suicide, and they were looking for someone who might have a motive. And it turned out that Megan Hargan, the day of the killings, was closing on a new home. And she tried to transfer more than $400,000 from her mom's bank account. The bank had a recording where Megan was pretending to be Pamela, her mom. And the detectives confront her and basically said, you presented yourself as someone you're not in order to, you know, secure a wire transfer for $400,000. And, you know, when you get into, regardless of the murder, which the murder is, that's going to be a grueling prosecution and defense anyways. But when you get into wire transfers, you know, the federal government likes to get involved because that's their favorite thing. But she's been found guilty. And I was watching some of this audio and some of the trial stuff. Like I said, live trial when it started, because I was following it sort of live, but is now going to be a sentencing matter, and they scheduled the sentencing for I think Halloween or somewhere around Halloween.
Wow.
It's like pretty far off.
Why?
When the jurisdiction that they're in has very specific PSI, like pre-sentencing investigation requirements. So there'll be like she's been found guilty by a jury. And now she'll basically have
Like 6 months, right?
Yeah.
Is that what they're talking about?
Yeah. And this will be a whole thing where they like prep mitigating and aggravating factors.
I just want to clarify. She was found guilty of murder.
She was found guilty of murder. And the jurors recommended 2 life sentences in prison. Although
that must be Virginia must not have the mandatory minimum of.
So
life in prison without the possibility of parole.
They could have recommended a sentence of 20 to life in each of the 2 first-degree murder convictions. Now, for Megan Hargan's part, she is still maintaining her innocence. But it's one of those, you know, cases that it's legally speaking, she's convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder. And now that's going to become a sentencing issue. So that'll happen later in the year. It sort of fell into this crazy ass rabbit hole we've been down about, like, you know, murder for financial gain.
Yeah. And
so that's why, like,
that's actually really different though. 'Cause we're talking about mom and sister.
Yeah, it was, well, I mean, I don't know how different. Yeah. That's
it's
different.
Very different.
But the motive, is the motive different? I don't think the motive's different.
The motive isn't different. You're right. The motive isn't different, but like the action is different.
Yeah. Just and these were rifle shots too, by the way.
Like what I mean is it would be less shocking at any point in time for someone to do anything to someone they don't know, right? If you, you know, if you have no regard for like humanity overall, a lot of times you'll still have regard for people that are close to you, right?
Yeah.
And so it's shocking, but I mean, the motive is, I guess, the same. I mean, because I don't know anything about this case, but you're saying that it was, she was closing on a house, but for some reason she needed $400,000.
Yeah.
Did she not have a mortgage lined up?
It didn't look like she even was close to qualifying based on what they presented.
Well, no, because she was paying cash. She was paying the cash that she was wiring.
Right, but I mean, it looked like one of those transactions that like real basic due diligence would have negated far before it got to this point. But so this all happens in July of 2017.
I was going to say, when was that? Because you know the mortgage underwriting has changed drastically.
Yeah, so in July of 2017, they alleged that, so she was living there. Megan Hargan was living with Pamela Hargan. So she's the oldest daughter of Pamela Hargan. And then she has a younger sister, and Pamela has a younger daughter named Helen. And not only was Megan living there, but Megan's 7-year-old daughter was living there with them. So she was in the house the night that it all happened. And that was one point they kept sort of driving home. Now, I will say this. In terms of investigation, it took them until November of 2018. So this murder happens July, I think it's July 14th, 2017. And then the arrest happens November 18th, 2018.
So over a year.
Yeah, it's like, I thought it was, you know, fascinating that it took them that long until I started seeing the investigation unfold. And they took their time where I don't want to say they baited her into thinking she got away with it, but they did definitely give her like a chance to breathe in there where she didn't know they were coming after her and she made mistakes. It was really smart on the part of the investigators involved. Like they did a really good job. So that case at some point would be worth looking at because, you know, I'm down this crazy rabbit hole based on a question that you asked. So when we last had an episode up, we were talking about the case of Harold Henry. And we were sort of talking from the perspective of the end of Harold's life. We know that he was murdered. The question becomes, who did it?
I don't know that it's just we think. I feel like there was evidence presented that would make his demise otherwise unlikely.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. I just want to point out that like there's no conviction, there's no like legal part of this
case. His death hasn't been
been investigated.
Well, it was ruled to be or closed as being accidental.
Right. And so the idea was that he basically overdosed himself on Benadryl and left a note that said, I think I'm having a heart attack, cremate me.
Right. And the evidence that doesn't support that is the fact that there was no Benadryl found anywhere. Like no bottle, no box, no nothing. And there was no writing utensil that matched the note that he supposedly left, which said, you know, I'm having a heart attack, cremate me. And so those are two things that I don't know how long it would take somebody to overdose on Benadryl.
Well, it was counterindicated for one of the medications he was taking. So we don't have an idea. But we do know it was a large quantity of Benadryl.
I was going to say he had enough Benadryl in his system to kill him without the counterindication. Now, he also took a prescription that could have made it even worse. And right. So, but my point is, his son had the forethought to have the apartment manager hold the trash in the apartment. And so they never found the source of the writing on the note or the Benadryl.
Right.
And so it seems to me like, I mean, what did he do? Like, take everything out of the bottle and throw it away somewhere else?
I don't know what the idea was there. I mean, generally speaking, I think here's how the investigators landed on where they landed. Aside from the fact that, so this is the one where Jason Bobo is a Texas Ranger. He gets assigned with a guy named Lieutenant Innocencio from the local police department. And then after he gets into this investigation, the lieutenant kills himself. What I think they landed on was Harold thought he was going to get, and you pointed this out to me, Harold thought he was getting $7,500 back from Paige Massey, who is one of D. Ellen's appellate attorneys. And instead, that money had been redirected into this savings account for D. Ellen. So since the money was put into there instead, the idea was, and I think this is how you put it, I'm not looking at your words exactly, but I think you said that you believed he was going to take that money and relocate himself back to his family in South Dakota.
Well, what happened was when the money, he was waiting for that money to come back. And then at some point, he discovered that the money had been refunded, but it had been refunded to D. Ellen's savings account. And when he confronted her about it, she tried to tell him that he had okayed that arrangement. And he felt confident in the fact that he hadn't okayed that arrangement. And so, you know, in the situation he found himself in, I don't know if you remember from the previous episode, but like he had scribbled on the top of a note, like trust.
Yeah.
That had to do with what was happening there, right? Like she had essentially stolen that $7,500 from him.
Yeah. And so the other side of it was she, so we think he was prepping to go back to South Dakota. But acting like everything was normal, he had said something to her about like everything will be okay in a week,
and we never really got to the daughter.
Yeah, he said that to. So we never knew what the everything will be okay in a week was going to be like about. Probably him going home, and he's probably trying to reassure his children he was headed home.
Well, that's what I think. Now, when Deb questioned the situation and she made, Deb was his daughter, and she sort of made the rounds making phone calls to law enforcement and then the prison and then internal affairs and then adult protective services. Like she called everybody she possibly could. And at some point during all that, it's mentioned that D. Ellen had taken Harold off of her visitors list, or somebody had, right?
Correct.
And she kind of freaked out. She sent him kind of a nasty note saying, like, I need to know what you're doing financially. You can't just leave me in the dark. It was really strange. But all of a sudden, I know that he had told someone that it was all Deb's fault, right?
Yeah.
And that there was this back and forth. And D. Ellen had told Harold that it's sort of like, I'm putting words in her mouth here, but like sort of like, you can make it up to me by getting an insurance policy payable to me. He had an appointment to go and get the insurance policy. And so he had to have a physical for it. And that had happened. And during the physical, the doctor administering the physical, he wrote, you know, whatever it is that they write up, saying that there was a level of incompetence there, and he was saying that he couldn't make his own financial decisions anymore.
Right.
And essentially, I'm pretty sure that would preclude him from getting the policy, because he would need someone competent to be overseeing that process, right? Because you have to list a beneficiary and all that stuff, right?
Right.
And so I think that halted it. And then shortly thereafter, that had happened in him trying to get the policy, he died. And right. So it's this series of events. I don't think DLN realized the policy wasn't in effect. Deb had started these various sort of, she started questioning. And while it wasn't really gaining traction, I think that in a way, DLN was cutting bait and running because she knew it was all about to come like crashing down, right?
Yeah.
And so she was trying to get as much out of the situation as possible before she no longer could. Because what would have happened is they would have, somebody, it seems like, should have realized that she was manipulating him and then everything would have been undone. And so before that occurred, she wanted to get the annuity, which she thought she had, you know, access to, but it was gone. And then on the other hand, she thought a life insurance policy had went into effect, but the problem was he didn't complete the application process because the doctor said that he wasn't competent to deal with his finances by himself.
That's where we get to this point where, what do you do next with a case like this? These cases are very convoluted.
Let me ask you something. Do you think to yourself, well, he was an old man who died. That's what happened.
I mean, no, but it's hard for me to jump to first degree murder from it all. But I do get there with this case.
Okay. There's a lot that happens in like the overwhelming saga of this case, beginning with Sandy Dial's murder, you know, all the way through to Harold Henry's murder. And I don't want to say, like, I kind of discarded the situation. And I was telling you, like, I'd really like to know why I did that. And what I mean by that is, I don't know why. What I realized eventually wasn't immediately prevalent to me. And what I realized eventually was, like, this man was murdered. And it's really obvious that he was murdered. You know, it wasn't a shotgun blast to the back of the head like Sandy Dial suffered. But there was no difference in the fact that he ended up being murdered.
Where we get with this is, these type cases, because these people are older, they're very complex to investigate. So in order to like understand them, you sort of have to find other cases like them and to see what people did. With the case that we just covered, just all the DL and Bella kerfuffle, and I know that's a lightweight word to put on it, but the truth is she's sort of a Black Widow serial killer in her own way. And if you go back through the two episodes that we just did, it's very likely that there is someone still on the outside who is involved in how all of this went down. And like, I've made a conscious decision that we can't say who we think it is. But we do have someone that we think would be a wealth of information related to all of this, who is still on the outside, and could at least help point investigators in the right direction if there were investigators to look at this. So that is the first part I want to say. There's also, and I think you mentioned it in the episode, I sort of cut it down in a way that I didn't want to bring a lot of focus to it. There's these suicides, which I know we mentioned, but there's one particular suicide, which was of D.L. and Bella's son. And I think that would be another place to start, would be to go back and look at that suicide and just look to see if there were paperwork surrounding it indicating he was also insured. I'm not saying anything happened there. I'm just saying
With suicides, and I don't know, in 1996, I think is when he committed suicide. 98, okay. I don't know what the situation was, but a lot of times suicides void the policy.
They can. I mean, it sort of depends on how it's all written up. I mean, there are policies that are not always voided by suicide.
That's true. I mean, it just, you usually pay like a higher premium or whatever, but
there are also policies that you get double indemnity for murder or accidental death.
Right. Which is something, since we brought it back up, I had said previously, I didn't feel like Lynn Dial had any reason to want Sandy dead, even though he was successfully indicted. The charges were dropped against him. But I learned that the smaller insurance policy, he actually collected double indemnity on it because it was a murder.
And we did find a reference to Don Dial's phone number having been used on the application.
Correct. And another thing was there was a problem between Sandy Dial and Lynn Dial about the fact that he was being forced to pay her child support. So, you know, these little things have reared their ugly head. I was under the impression that because they were divorced, they had, you know, there was no reason for them to, for him to be wanting to kill her because they're divorced, right? They don't have to be together. But so anyway, these other things have come up. And so it is possible. I mean, he was indicted, right? But he was never prosecuted for it. The charges were dropped. The indictment was dropped.
So that case is just going to have to hang open for a little while. Now, when we look for similar cases to try and figure out how things would be handled, in this instance, this is how you sparked it off for me. You said, what do you think the percentage of people who die naturally are really people who are going out under a financial motive? Meaning an older person or any age, but particularly older people who have what is classified by a medical examiner and investigators as a natural, even an accidental death. They are exiting from life. And what really happened is someone assisted or caused their exit for an insurance policy or an inheritance or any other type of financial motive. Is that what you meant by that?
Yes. And actually, I'm pretty sure, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that every single one of those cases would be first degree murder.
Yeah, it would be. There's a level of plotting that goes in there where, I mean, some of these cases could plea out to second degree or something else, but like for the most part, they're plotted murders. It's just a very small conspiracy and that it usually only involves one or two people. In a lot of instances, it's only one person plotting it to do it
and
with
that's
the assistance of one other person.
Well, that's when typically people don't get caught. Now, it's interesting because, you know, Harold's death was chalked up to the fact that he was old and he had a heart attack, right? That's what they essentially said. Despite the fact that he had all that Benadryl in his system, he had a neck injury. It was just, you know, this is an accident, right?
Right.
And it's sort of like, well, you know, is that all you got? Is that the threshold you have to meet to get away with something like this? Now, like I said in the other episode, for whatever reason, you know, D'Ellen Bella is so smart that she has yet to collect anything from any of these crimes that we know of, right?
Yeah, we don't. So that's why, you know, and so now I'm getting into pure speculation land, and I'm not going to use the name D'Ellen Bella, whatever. I'm just going to say you would have to go through some
everybody that's died.
Yeah, like you would have to start going through the older people, particularly in these people's lives, and determine who might have died under odd circumstances. Now, I did not find anything linked to D'Ellen Bella in my hunt for this, but you came up with a case that, and that's the episode today. We're going to talk about this other case because I found a way to tell this story so that I think that you can get a really good picture of how this could happen. Would you agree that this other story, as crazy as it is, tells like a pretty interesting...
I think that it's just extreme enough to explain the basic concept, yes.
Okay, so in 2014, a woman named Thelma Mae Nell, who went by the name Penny, She was hospitalized. She had been married to her husband, Martin, for 70 years. Penny was 93 years old. So prior to Penny's discharge from the hospital, her husband, Martin, appointed GVH, or the Greater Valley Hospice, to administer Penny's hospice care at the couple's home. A woman named Kathy Redfern ordered medical equipment to be delivered to the couple's home, and she spoke with Martin and confirmed all of the arrangements for the at-home hospice care. Martin basically doesn't say to Kathy, "I can't handle Penny coming home." Kathy's not sure, like, if she should do anything extra. But these are much older people. So 93 years old. Think about that for a second. 93 years old. And they've been married for 70 years. They're around the same age. So he's in his 90s trying to care for his wife who's in his 90s, who is dying. On the evening of Penny's transport, between 10:30 and 11 o'clock, Kathy Redfern receives a call from a administrator. Is a person who is in charge of, like, sort of a project manager for all of the care under GVH, or Greater Valley Hospice, in making sure that there is a sort of a peaceful transition. For those of you who don't know exactly what hospice care means, my understanding of hospice care is that it's when you're on the very end of your journey in life, hospice care is made to make it as comfortable as possible in as familiar a surroundings or settings as possible. Is that your understanding?
It is. And I just want to point out that while every indication here, you said that Penny was essentially dying. And so what I found was she was 93 years old. And at that point in time, I would feel like a lot of your time is spent dying, right? Because you're 93 years old. But at the same time, she had been in the hospital because her husband had mismanaged some of the medications she was taking. And she was actually in okay shape. So she wasn't actually dying, but she had had an issue, right? And they were sending her home.
Right.
Okay. I just wanted to make that clear because it's actually really important for the story.
Right. And it's not just it's not malicious mismanagement.
No, this is her husband trying to take care of her and not being able to.
Correct. So Kathy Redfern, she's the director of nursing. She gets a call. And in this call, a woman named Monica, who is in charge of sort of the project of getting Penny home and making sure that the house is set up so that Penny can be there. She says that Martin, Penny's husband, is refusing to allow any of the GVH staff to move Penny back into the couple's residence. So at this point in time, Penny is instead transported to what's known as Comfort, or Comfort House Services. Upon Penny's admittance to Comfort, a gentleman named Mark, who's actually Martin Nell Jr., meaning this is the son of Martin and Penny. He's their only son. He becomes the established point of contact. So Mark's relationship with his parents is looked over the course of this whole incident and the aftermath. And he was accused of trying to assume control of his parents' finances, which he denies. All of the parties involved in this dispute, whether or not Mark, the son, set up a way for Martin, the husband, to be barred from visiting Penny at Comfort Houses, or if the staff from Comfort Services was involved in barring Martin from visiting.
If I could jump in here just really quick. When he refused to allow his wife back into his house, there was an actual, he didn't have the cognitive presence to say, like, you can't bring her in because I can't take care of her. He was saying, you cannot take her in, and if you do, I'm going to shoot you. And he was wielding a gun, right?
Yeah.
And so it was a confrontation. Now, at the end of that confrontation, it was realized that he basically wasn't able to articulate what he was getting at. But what he meant was, if you bring her in here for me to take care of her, she's going to die. So don't bring her in here because I can't take care of her, right?
Right.
And it was this huge misunderstanding, really. But they confiscated his weapons and they let him off with a warning at that point. So his wife is transferred to this, it's not a hospital, but it's a, it's a care facility.
It's where, a residential care facility.
Correct. And so they had a bed available, and their son lived like 3 hours or 4 hours away. And so he had tried to make these arrangements. But because of the confrontation that occurred before it got cleared up, like with him saying, you can't bring her in the house, she's going to die or whatever, they weren't sure what was happening. And so he was initially not allowed in the facility to see his wife.
Yes. So they do set it up where, and later this comes out in a trial, where Mark, the son, testifies that the facility itself was placed on lockdown and that they had requested law enforcement intervention because they were concerned with Martin threatening the staff, the people trying to care for Penny.
Right. And because that came on the heels of this other incident where they had confiscated his weapon. So it seems unlikely he would have been armed, but they actually involuntarily commit him for a short period of time. And that's how their son Mark gets put in charge of Penny's health care while he's being evaluated during this involuntary commitment. But, you know, fortunately, during the involuntary commitment, they figure out what this big mystery was, which It's not that he's lost his mind and he's going to kill everybody, but he's very upset that his wife, you know, was in peril because of his inability to care for her, and they get it all sorted out.
Right. So on September 29th, 2 days after she's admitted into this residential care facility, Martin goes down to the Hidalgo County Sheriff's Office, and he tells them that he is now being unlawfully prohibited from visiting her. And Cesar Garza is a criminal investigator at the Sheriff's Office. He calls over and he speaks with both the admitting caregiver, who is a man named Michael Marinos, and with the woman who is the project manager in charge of this, Monica Patterson. Monica Patterson tells Garza that she filed a police report with the McAllen Police Department after Martin threatened the staff and caused a disturbance. She explains that Martin was prohibited from entering the facility because of his violent tendencies and access to weapons. And so Garza, after collecting this information, he relays it back to Martin, who was visibly upset. As a result of his response, this is the moment where they commit him for a mental health evaluation. According to Brenda Lee Cantu, who is a representative with the Adult Protective Services Agency within the Department of Family Protective Services, Monica also reports Martin to APS, alleging elder abuse and neglect for refusing to care for Penny. On October 1st, Brenda Cantu contacted Martin at the behavioral center where he had been institutionalized. Cantu was tasked with reviewing Martin's adult daily living situation and determining whether he was capable of performing basic tasks. And in Brenda's opinion, she believed that he was. And so the day that she goes in to reviews his situation, Martin is discharged the same day. Once he's released, Martin immediately goes to visit his wife at Comfort. This time, he's accompanied by Max Grubb, and Max Grubb is a pastor and a longtime friend of the family. He says that upon their arrival at the Comfort Houses, Monica told them that they would not be allowed inside because they had been ordered by Mark, the son, not to allow Martin to come in. Grubb then expressed his concerns to Monica regarding rumors of Mark's alleged improper financial interest in Martin's significant fortune. Basically, the pastor says, look, we're a little worried that something is going on here where the son is trying to do something to the parents in order to get his hands on their money. After this happens, and Grubb mentions all of this to Monica, her demeanor changes, and Martin is allowed to come inside to visit with Penny. On October the 5th, Mark informs Monica that he would be transferring his mom to Waterford Gardens Assisted Living Facility, pending authorization and the availability of a bed. Mark later says that Monica initially assured him that she would arrange this transfer. And when Mark follows up with Monica, she told him that Lucille Cavazos, who is the administrator at the Waterford Gardens, had denied the transfer. According to Lucille Cavazos, this was a lie. Cavazos stated that Monica never gave her the opportunity to evaluate Penny for any kind of placement. Monica said, I might not be able to handle the husband, and that he was going to go, that he was having to go visit, escorted by a policeman, because he had threatened the Comfort facility. This is a quote from Cavazos. Monica insisted that she needed to ask the family for permission before she would allow Cavazos to evaluate Penny in person for placement suitability in a bed at Waterford Gardens. Although Mark, who was still listed as Penny's primary point of contact, was supporting the transfer.
Right. So what's happening there is basically because of all the hubbub, Mark wants to get his mom in a different facility where his dad can go in and visit with no problem now that they've got it sorted. And the director of the facility Penny is currently in is simultaneously saying she's helping and blocking it at the same time.
Right. Within a week of Mark requesting that Penny be transferred and setting up the Waterford Gardens evaluation, Mark has removed his Penny's primary point of contact at Comfort and replaced with Martin. And Monica accompanies Martin to Chase Bank to inquire about withdrawing Martin's money. There's a Chase personal banker named Rocio Perez. And according to this banker, Monica and Martin ask if there was a way to keep the money safe from Mark. At this time, Martin had approximately $600,000 in his account. Perez, who was familiar with Martin and had never known him to make such a large withdrawal, grew concerned during the encounter, and he contacted Global Security Investigations and reported it as possible elder abuse. So he doesn't really know who this woman is that's with Martin, but he's concerned that there's some kind of sketchy stuff going on.
It was very inappropriate for her to do that.
Yeah, that was the first thing she did that was inappropriate. That was the first thing that she did that was financially inappropriate. She's crossing a line there that, like, she just had no reason. The other stuff could all be explained, but that visit to Chase Bank could not.
Well, he wasn't even in her care. Like, it was his wife that was in her facility.
Right.
And so the only thing I would consider to be appropriate from a director of a care facility when a husband has expressed concerns would be to bring in protective services or a licensed financial person, right?
Yeah.
It was not appropriate for her to go to the bank with him.
Perez, the banker there, he goes pretty far in his statement about this whole situation. He says that Martin was a really well-known customer. Like, they knew him by face and they talked to him. And he said anytime there were no customers like in the lobby of the bank, he said Martin would come in and just talk about what was going on. Rocio also gave a statement that she used to join Martin and Penny for lunch. And more recently, after Penny had been transferred into hospice and Martin had been put in the institution, it was her husband that helped Martin get his car back from the impound lot. So this is not just a banker who's like waving at someone in the line. This is someone who's personally involved in their life. Monica kept getting more and more interested in Martin's finances. This was further corroborated by Pastor Grubb, and his statement indicated that in early to mid-October, Monica had approached him with a proposal about taking care of Martin's money. Pastor Grubb said that Monica suggested that Martin take his money out of the bank and give it to her so she could protect it. Grubb vocalized his disapproval, and in response, Monica proposed that she and Grubb split the money. Shortly after this exchange with Monica, Grubb said that he convinced Martin to meet with a local attorney named Oscar Gomez. Not long after this all happened, Pastor Grubb underwent open-heart surgery, and he lost contact with Martin for several months while he was recovering.
Can I ask you something? What is your opinion about, like, what was just posited there that, you know, the director of the care facility that his wife is at has now approached the pastor and said, you know, let me take out the money so I can keep it safe. And then when he opposes that, she says, well, we'll split it and we'll both keep it safe. Okay. What's the difference between them taking his money and him being concerned that his son is going to take his money?
I think she misread Pastor Grubb's ambivalence. I think he was not trying to judge her. And she thought...
He didn't go along with it. He said it was a terrible idea, right?
Well, yeah, he gets Oscar Gomez involved.
Right, but in it... But, like, what is the thought process that Monica Patterson is having that makes her think that, you know, because I'm just thinking from the point of view of the child, who's not a child, he's an adult, but, you know, the entitlement there, like, let me, you know, you're concerned that your son's going to steal your money, so why don't I steal it instead? I mean, that's all I can kind of process there, and it's sort of like... What? Because it doesn't make any sense to me that there's a, like, because, I mean, those are the exact words that are used, that she said, let me, you know, take it out of the bank and keep it so I can keep it safe for him, right? Oh, yeah. There's, yeah, like, nothing in a professional capacity that a care facility director would be doing in you know, fulfilling what she's suggesting.
That setup makes me wonder if it's like a crime of opportunity. She realized it.
Well, I think that he planted the seed when it started, and he said,
I know, when he said, we're worried about Mark Jr., we're worried about the kid.
I think that she got an idea.
Yeah. Well, so Oscar Gomez later says that he met with Martin after Pastor Grubb introduced them. He met with him on four occasions, but ultimately didn't end up providing any legal services to Martin, citing a conflict of interest. Gomez said that for the exception of the first meeting when Pastor Grubb came with him, Martin would arrive alone without an appointment, and he would just show up to chat, and that he tried to tell Martin, you know, this is going to be expensive. And Martin would just say, oh, I'm paying you. You sit there and you listen to me.
Do you know what that conflict of interest was?
Not off the top of my head.
I think, well, I don't know for certain. I don't think it's actually spelled out, but I felt like the conflict of interest was ultimately Pastor Grubb recommended him to go see this attorney, and he was in the will.
Oh, okay.
And so, okay, so we've got an attorney that's been recommended by a friend. Right. And that attorney talks with Martin and ultimately doesn't do anything. They don't talk about if he was paid or whatever, but he doesn't do anything. And I felt like it was because the person who recommended that he go see him was already in the will that was already there. Right.
Got it.
Okay. And so that just gives you a little bit of an idea, right?
Yeah.
That's a conflict of interest, according from my perspective, that made sense, right?
Yeah.
Even though it's not like an insurmountable conflict of interest, especially if, you know, it stayed the same as opposed to Pastor Grubb getting more money, yeah, or something. I feel like it could be, you know, a little bit ambiguous as far as like, is it actually, but that's the professional etiquette is to err on the side of caution.
Yes. So now after this happens and the conflict of interest has occurred, we don't know the dates. I don't personally know the dates of like when the attorney, Mr. Gomez and Martin are talking, but on October the 13th, Martin goes in and withdraws $100,000 from his Chase account. A week later, he shows up again at Chase, but this time Monica's with them, and they attempt to make another significant cash withdrawal. Now we get the Chase Bank branch manager, a guy named Amador Lopez Jr. He gets into the middle of this situation, and he says that the bank cannot fulfill Martin's request to withdraw $150,000 that day. The reason that was given is just that they have to basically schedule this in order to have the cash and the available for Martin, and they want to do that. So Lopez does take this opportunity to introduce himself to Monica, and he either convinces her or she ends up like liking the conversation. She ends up opening an account at this Chase Bank and then begins to receive multiple transfers from Martin's account into her own account. According to Lopez, Martin's balance at the beginning of October was $600,046.78. And by the first day of November, Martin's account reflected $189,589.97. So at one point, Monica even requests a meeting with Lopez Jr. She tries to convince him that the money being received back and forth across their accounts is being received legitimately. On October 28th, Penny passes away. So Martin's wife passes away on October the 28th. 3 days after Penny's funeral, Raquel Ibarra, who was Penny's former medical social worker over at GVH, she came and visited Martin at his home to offer bereavement counseling services. Ibarra noted that Martin appeared to be coping well and had a strong support system in place, which included his family and his pastor. Mark, the son, confirmed that he spoke with his father frequently after Penny passed, often multiple times a day. On November the 24th, during a follow-up bereavement visitation, Ibarra stated that the visitation atmosphere unexpectedly changed after Martin received a letter indicating that Monica's name had been added as a transfer on the death title to his stockholder account. Martin became very angry. His voice was trembling and really loud, described Ibarra. Martin told her that he had trusted Monica with his money and his stock information and that Monica was, quote, holding $300,000 for him, end quote. She watched as Martin called Monica and demanded that Monica come now to his home and then contacted the stockholder company and was inquiring about the unauthorized changes when Monica arrived at the residence. He asked Monica to speak to the customer service rep and revert any changes she previously made without his permission. At the end of the phone call, however, Monica's changes remained in effect. Ibarra said that Monica had attempted to deflect Martin's concerns by asking Martin if he had taken his medication. Martin then accused Monica of undermining him and maybe conspiring with his son to get his money. He told Monica that he wanted his $300,000 back from her. Monica refused to address Martin's allegations, claiming she would not discuss any privileged information in front of Ibarra. As Ibarra gathered her belongings to leave, Monica asked Ibarra to have her GVH supervisors, Kathy Redfern and Danielle Martinez, contact Monica. So,
what do you think? Why do you think that she thought there was some sort of privilege to invoke there?
I have no idea. She's lost her damn mind.
At this point, Penny has died. He is not a resident of the care facility, so...
why is she still here? Why does she have any of this man's money? What is going on?
You know, it's a little bit crazy, but it... And see, her statement there, her account of what is happening, it indicates that Martin still thinks Mark is after his money.
Right.
And there's never any indication that Mark had even the slightest interest in any sort of like financial windfall from like killing off one of his parents at all. Like he lives elsewhere. He has his own family. He's successful. There's no reason, you know, that he would be after their money, so to speak. Now, that's not to say that he wouldn't be entitled to it, right? After they die, he's their child.
Right. So Ibarra goes back and she makes a report to Kathy Redfern. And based on the report that Redfern received about this incident, coupled with other prior documented concerns, she contacts Adult Protective Services. And then she goes above and beyond and contacts the Texas Attorney General and the Better Business Bureau. They also go so far as to file a police report. And an investigator with the McAllen Police Department is dispatched to Martin's home the following day. So Martin believes that Mark is making these reports. And when he starts to talk to the investigator, it sort of becomes clear that Martin doesn't understand that what's been going on with him has actually been caused by Monica. In fact, investigator Stephen Medrano, he says in his reports that Martin seemed to be confused about events and time. And his suspicions were further piqued when Martin identifies himself as being 64 years old. And at the time that he identifies himself as being 64 years old, Martin is 96. So Medrano, the investigator, he bumps the case up to a supervisor. And that supervisor gets in touch with APS to make sure they have that report. All right. You follow me so far there?
Yeah.
All right. So that's based on what Kathy Redfern did. So the other supervisor was Danielle Martinez. Danielle Martinez, she reaches out to Monica over at Comfort House. Monica tells Martinez that Ibarra had simply observed Martin in a moment of anger and confusion and had to remind him of what he wanted her to do. Her observations indicated that Monica was speaking cyclically, like in a circle.
Cyclically.
She would maintain that it was a legal issue and that she could not speak to Martinez in detail, but there were lawyers involved. Martinez further stated that it was a very unorthodox and odd conversation. And consequently, she documented the discussion and her subsequent discussions with Monica in significant detail. There's even an indication that several hours after the initial contact, Martinez received a phone call from Monica's personal cell phone. And Monica passed the phone over to Martin, who said that he didn't want this lady to get in trouble for the Comfort House to get shut down. He said that this lady, although I can't remember her name, I know her face, has been there to support me, and her smile lights up my day. Martin then began discussing his personal visitation matters with his son and extended family. Martina said she was confused, but she wasn't allowed to ask any clarifying questions. And she noted that throughout the conversation, there was continuous whispering in the background, and every time that happened, the conversation would be redirected away from her inquiries. Ibarra stated that Martin had contacted her separately to apologize, telling her that it was all a big misunderstanding and that Monica would be returning his $300,000 to him and for her not to worry. In early December, Mark observed a change in Martin's demeanor. When he was asked to elaborate on a change in his demeanor, he surmised only that his father's attitude became horrible. Mark last spoke with his dad on December the 3rd. And on December the 7th, Jose Quintanilla, who was an investigator at the time for Adult Protective Services, said that he visited Martin's residence to investigate a report of elder exploitation. This was the second APS report that had been filed involving Martin in a six-month period. The next day, Martin sought out local attorney Mark Talbot under the direction of Monica, who made the appointment and accompanied him to the meeting. At the December 8th meeting, Martin executed a medical power of attorney, a HIPAA medical disclosure, and a directive to physicians designating that Monica would be his primary agent on all forms. Talbot inquired whether Martin wanted to execute the documents outside of Monica's presence, and Martin declined. Talbot stated that he believed Martin had no problem communicating with him or understanding him, and he also received letters from Dr. Jose Igoa, who is a well-known psychiatrist in Hidalgo County, and Luis Arango, who is Martin's primary physician, confirming that Martin was competent. On December the 12th, Martin executed a financial power of attorney, also naming Monica as his agent. On December the 16th, Ibarra attempted to visit Martin at his home and received no response. Redfern and Martinez stated that they had sent a typed letter. This was wherein Martin was apologizing about the dispute that the DVH, that the hospice got caught up in. Martin also alleged that he had been disturbed by a hospice representative from GVH who had been in his home for an excessively lengthy period inquiring about his financial matters. Danielle Martinez described the letter as odd, and from her previous discussions, what she understood about Martin was that he did not know how to use a computer and did not own a computer. Martinez followed up on Martin's allegation and determined that it was unsupported by the employee logs. So basically, she gets this letter that's claiming that Martin was attempting to discontinue his bereavement services and had a complaint because the bereavement counselor was essentially badgering him about his finances. When this happens, she has to investigate because, like, she's actually doing her job, and so is Redfern for the most part. They're doing their jobs just following up because Penny died while she was under their hospice care. So Martin's last will and testament was signed on December the 22nd. Monica was designated as the executor and beneficiary of two of Martin's properties and the rest of the estate. The next day, Martin sustained a fall in Monica's home while showering. Erica Garcia, who is a registered nurse at Proficient Home Care Solutions and was responsible for recertifying Martin every 60 days for service eligibility, testified that physical therapy was ordered for Martin following his fall. She stated he was weak, he was needing the furniture and chairs to hold him up, and his gait was very unsteady. A week after that, Monica called Garcia to cancel physical therapy because Martin had recently learned his cancer was spreading. According to Garcia, Martin had been previously diagnosed with coronary artery disease, heart hypertrophy, and myocardial fibrosis. In 2012, Martin was diagnosed with stage 3 multiple myeloma, and he underwent treatment. His medical records that were gathered by the investigators indicated that he was asymptomatic in June of 2014. So this would have been 4 years prior and had nothing to do with the words that Monica was spouting.
Right. She was just lying about it.
Yeah.
So she's like, she was plotting how he was going to go out.
Pretty much. She was definitely, she was paving the path here.
Yep.
So between late December and early January, a woman named Celestina Mascoro began working for Martin as a lemon housekeeper on the weekdays. Monica would relieve her on the weekends, and Mascoro stated that she was responsible for bathing Martin, cleaning around the house, doing laundry, fixing his meals, and driving him around. Celestina Mascoro said that Monica instructed her on how to care for Martin and ensured that Mascoro intercepted all of the phone calls coming in for him. Celestina stated that Monica wanted me to let her know whoever called, make sure that they wouldn't, the sons or the grandkids, they weren't supposed to talk to Martin. At an unspecified point in time, Celestina met a man named Mario, whom she only knew as a comfort contracted handyman. And she stated that she had seen Mario at Martin's residence on two prior occasions to deliver a hospital bed and to fix a leaky shower head. According to a woman named Liana Benavides, who is an employee for Comfort, Mario began to volunteer at Comfort in September of 2014 after his father was admitted as a patient. Liana testified that Mario and Monica had reached an arrangement, and that was that Mario's father could remain at Comfort House in exchange for Mario working there because Mario could not afford home care otherwise. And after the events of this story, Mario abruptly stopped volunteering. And I think that's probably, like, that sort of sets up part one of this.
Well, sure. Yeah. I think so.
So just to recap, what we have that's happened here is a woman named Penny and her husband of 70 years, Martin. They randomly end up in a situation where Martin has screwed up Penny's medications and care is being arranged in their home after she has to go to the hospital. And because of this care that is arranged in her home, they get pushed into the path of a woman who sort of hones in on their finances. And this woman, Monica, starts to ingratiate herself into all of Martin's personal affairs. And after Penny dies, it extends beyond the being ingrained in them. And she's suddenly in charge of them with legal documents.
Actually, she's suddenly like just they're hers now.
It's bizarre. Like,
well, and I want to say, so we didn't talk about it. It's not as relevant here. And there's reasons why it's not as relevant here because of the way the situation played itself out. But after Penny had gotten situated in the Comfort House and, you know, everything was back on track, she recovered very well.
Yes.
Okay. And her son had come. They were actually married for 73 years. Upon their 74th anniversary, their son and his wife and kids or the family had come to the facility to celebrate with the parents what would be their 74th wedding anniversary. When that happened, when they went in, Monica pulled Mark, who is their son, aside and advised him that his mother would more than likely not make it through the night. And he was shocked because she had been doing so well. And he couldn't figure out she was, you know, 93 or 94 years old at that point in time. But to be in a care facility and have your health decline like it did, didn't make sense to him.
Yeah.
And you have to keep in mind that in the meantime, while it started with Mark being in control, Monica kind of quickly switched Martin being back in control of Penny's medical issues, right?
Yeah.
And so as a son, he wanted to respect his father's wishes, right? But at the same time, like, I would expect that the care facility would ultimately do what's best. But as I got sort of into this, I realized, like, this isn't so much like a medical facility as it is just a care facility. So, like, whatever Martin said went, right?
And they probably would have to figure out a way to transfer her if, like, she needed some kind of actual care, and there would be very few people to observe something happening to her.
Well, and you know, so this starts because he couldn't take care of her. She gets sick and she's got to get it straightened out. And then he doesn't want her to come back because he knows he can't take care of her. Okay. And then they give it right back to him. The health. Command or whatever they call it. But so, yeah, I feel like that that lays out that part of the story pretty well.
Thank you for joining us. We are sponsored by LabrotiCreations.com. You can check them out at LabrotiCreations.com, and you can still use the code CRIMEXS for a fun pop pet portrait of your own pet. You can also reach us on Twitter, Instagram, at TrueCrimeXS, or you can give us a call if you know anything about any of the cases that we're talking about at 252-365-5593. You can also reach us at Gmail at truecrimexs@gmail.com, and you can check out our website at www.truecrimexs.com. We'll see you next time.
This is True Crime XS.